Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Don't desert the deserts. That's the slogan for this International Year of Deserts and Desertification. Jesuit Refugee Service accompanies millions of men, women and children living outside their countries of origin, often in clandestinity, nearly always in pain. And Father Jim Brand tells us about the amazing thing that happens in the Annunciation. Did you know that deserts cover about one-fifth of the Earth's surface? Reading up on them, I also discovered that although deserts occur where rainfall is less than 50 centimetres a year, they have a considerable amount of specialised vegetation, as well as vertebrate and invertebrate animals. Now why, you're probably wondering, this sudden interest for deserts? It's simple. Not only is 2006 the International Year of Deserts and Desertification, June the 17th is World Day to Combat Desertification, a day in which to highlight the fact that desertification is of global concern and in which to celebrate the fragile beauty and unique heritage of our deserts.
Deserts are actually beautiful places that one should seek to visit.
Sheila Munundu is Senior Technical Advisor on Environmental and Natural Resource Management at IFAD. That's the International Fund for Agricultural Development.
They have biodiversity, biological diversity of its kind, which is unique in any area, and that's something that we should try and preserve. In addition to that, the beauty of it is in terms of the oases, in areas where oases can be found. And if we do promote sustainable practices, you find that it can be green with trees, and with the agroforestry and rangeland practices. So desert should not be a place that we as a community should desert, but we should try and help those communities to make this an area which can be sustainable to promote the livelihoods of those communities.
So that's the slogan, don't desert the deserts.
Yeah. Don't desert the deserts, that's the slogan for the World Environment Day. And I think it's a very valid point and something that we really should take very seriously.
And that's what Sheila does. Take the problem of desertification and the effect it has on the communities that live in or on the fringes of deserts so seriously. She has recently travelled to China to participate in the Beijing International Conference on Women and Desertification.
It's one of the events of the International Year for Deserts and Desertification. And it was basically to address the issue of women and how they address the problem of desertification. The participants included representatives from governments, NGOs, civil society and donor organizations. And there was a lot of discussion on the issues, and we ended up with the Beijing endorsement statement, which mentions a lot of things.
For example, I asked Sheila, what exactly were you there for?
Our basic aim was to go there and launch our publication on the work we've done in our developing countries. And the idea was to share some of the innovative approaches that have come up in the developing countries and to strategize on ways forward of how to better mainstream gender into related issues.
Why is gender such an issue when we talk about desertification?
Well, gender is an issue because, for example, we find that women play a key role in managing natural resources in these areas and also in food production. And these areas that tend to be degraded severely affect the livelihoods of women. And because they're generally involved in subsistence and small economies, we find that the land degradation makes them more vulnerable. And it's for that reason that the issue of women is considered as key when it comes to promoting sustainable management in these areas.
Yes, that makes sense. It's traditionally the women who devote time and effort to the land. They grow, process, manage, and market most of the food and other natural resources that come from the earth. That means they have direct experience of environmental degradation. And that's why promoting their participation in planning and decision-making can really ultimately make the difference. But meanwhile, I asked Sheila, what exactly is desertification?
Desertification can be generally termed as a process of land degradation which eventually results in desert formation. It's caused by two factors. It could be either natural factors or man-made activities or a combination of the two. With regard to man-made activities, it results into deforestation, soil erosion, water pollution, loss of biodiversity in these areas. And you find that degraded land leads to reduction in agricultural productivity, and this in turn reduces land carrying capacity and loss of sustainability. And this therefore leads to increased poverty, and increasingly over the years, we are now seeing the issue of environmental refugees.
Environmental refugees are people who leave their land in search of a better livelihood elsewhere. This is yet another phenomenon, Sheila points out, that directly affects the women.
Most of these people tend to be men, so which means the women and the children are left behind, and the men either migrate to the urban areas in search of income, additional income, or they move to other countries across the borders to areas where they can get better livelihoods. So you therefore find that the women who are left behind take on additional roles, responsibilities that are traditionally used to be held by men. And we are noticing that this additional responsibility is not coupled with greater access to decision making or to community facilities or to availability of technology or finance or other resources. Therefore, the women left behind, you find that their already heavy workloads already become even more burdensome.
And that takes us back to the Beijing conference. Having pinpointed the major problems, I asked Sheila what was decided.
The conference ended with the endorsement of a Beijing statement, which actually reaffirms the importance of joint efforts by the international community in combating desertification. And this should be taken as a global issue. The important contribution of women in promoting natural resource management was recognized, but at the same time it was acknowledged that there's a lack of recognition of their role. So the international community was called upon to reinforce their efforts in combating desertification, and five key points were agreed on. The need to promote women's greater access to productive assets, including technology. The second one is on institutional strengthening, which should include empowerment of women, capacity building, and the development of policies that are incentive-based. Thirdly is for communities and the international institutions to have joint implementation arrangements. The fourth one is improved funding at the national level, and especially with regards to women, if they could be given greater access to microcredit and savings facility. And the last one, which is equally important, is on better reporting and monitoring of the situation on the ground and the need to capture lessons that are learned and to disseminate them to other regions where they'll be most applicable.
What about us? I mean, people in the Western world, in countries where there is no desert, for example. Do you think it's important that there should be awareness of the problem?
Well, I think it should be important because desertification is actually transnational in nature. So it's not something that can be addressed just at the country level. And therefore, addressing the issue calls for enhanced implementation strategies at the international level and at the sub-regional level. And such strategies would include things like incorporating institutional aspects, transferring sound, sustainable land management practices, coming up with innovative mechanisms. And in order to do this in an effective manner, I think the international community not only those at the national levels, but also at our level, should come together in a bid to fight and combat this issue, which is really affecting local lives in the affected areas.
Yes, although we may choose Iceland, for example, for our next holiday, that doesn't mean the problem doesn't concern us. And Sheila points out, there have in fact been some positive developments. There are signs of hope that deserts haven't been completely deserted.
There are actually things happening on the ground. For example, here in IFAD, we've done a review of our projects that have been approved since 1999. And we found that there are changes happening. And some of the lessons we've learned is we have managed to help countries fulfill the objectives in meeting the obligations to the United Nations Conference on Desertification by promoting, for example, the use of time-saving technology so that women can spend less time on activities such as collecting water and fuel wood.
In the desert, it must take a long time to collect water and fuel wood.
Yes, it does take a long time, and that's why if we did come up with innovative technologies such as energy-saving stoves, or in the case of water, bringing water to the people and not having them walk long distances, and in promoting conservation measures, that will go a long way towards helping affected communities.
Other important arms, Sheila says, are raising awareness and providing education, empowering groups of women, providing basic infrastructure and improving women's access to markets. All things that work towards the promotion of sustainable conservation practices on desert lands. So it seems to me, it's very much up to the women of the deserts to save these precious and fragile lands. Sheila too confessed that although the role of men is important, she has been deeply inspired.
Women actually inspire me. When you go out to the desert areas or to the drylands, you see women with smiles on their faces going about their work and taking everything quite easy, though the situation can be quite difficult. And I must say that I admire their strength. And I'm not just talking of the physical strength, but I'm talking of their inner strength. And that is what inspires me.
My conversation about deserts not only gave me a whole new perspective on, what was it, 1/5 of the Earth's surface, it also brought up an issue I feel deeply for, and that's the issue of refugees and the always difficult, often tragic predicament so many people face every day. Actually, I discovered that according to a recent census, at least 175 million people, and that's men, women and children, are estimated to be living outside their country of origin. The Jesuit Refugee Service is a church-based organisation that accompanies many of these people, serving them as companions and advocating their cause in a largely uncaring world.
We have projects in 53 countries around the world, and those projects work directly with refugees and forcibly displaced people.
Melanie Teff is International Advocacy Coordinator of JRS.
A lot of our projects are focused on education, running schools or improving teacher training. In projects around the world for refugee children, we have many health projects and income-generating schemes. We have staff visiting people who are held in detention centres because of their immigration status. We do human rights protection work. And really, we like to consult with refugees in an area to find out from them what are the priority issues they would like us to work on. And then we try to set up projects in line with the wishes of the refugees themselves.
What are their priorities?
Clearly, that depends on the area where they're located. Situations are different for an internally displaced person in Aceh to a refugee in Europe, or, say, a Burundian refugee in Tanzania. But overall, if one was to generalise, I would say that refugees very often tell us that their overwhelming priority is for a durable solution to their situation. They want to know what is the future for them, and so they want to work towards some sort of hope for the future. If they are forcibly having to stay in exile for many years, most refugees tell us they want to do something to build their skills so that in the future, wherever that future may be, they will be able to contribute more to society and to their own families. That's why JRS has so often focused on education programs, because education and training, skills training, is something that you can offer to people while they're in exile. And you know that that's giving people hope for the future, and it means that they will be able to contribute if they are able to return home in the future, or if they're resettled to a third country, or if they are going to be locally integrated into the country of asylum. So I would say hope for the future and prospects of a project for developing their lives is what most refugees articulate to us as their needs.
Hope for the future and a project for their lives seem like perfectly reasonable aspirations to me. Melanie thinks so too, and she says that sharing experiences and creating empathy are an important part of the way to go.
JRS has actually a number of projects, particularly in European countries, of awareness raising in schools. We often work with refugees and JRS staff and refugees, and some JRS staff, of course, are refugees, go and talk in schools about their experiences to get children to understand what people have gone through, and not to just see the headlines in the newspapers that may be negative about refugees, but to see an individual and hear that person's story and get them to think about how their own lives could be affected if some trauma happened to them, if they had to become refugees.
So education and empathy are part of the game. But exactly who does JRS turn to promote its cause?
We advocate our cause with partners who work with us. We always like to call on churches and other religious organisations to work with us in promoting the rights of refugees. And we also work in partnership with some human rights organisations. JRS in different countries will do lobbying at different levels and advocacy at different levels. JRS will do lobbying at the national political level. And also with UN organisations, we like to remind governments of the shared responsibility that the world has for protecting refugees.
Would you say there is room for optimism in the near future?
I think that we have to be optimistic. I think that if we reach out to the general public and we put a human face on the refugees that we're talking about, we don't talk about a mass of 45 million people. We get people to see the humanity of the individuals we're talking about. And I think that individuals in those general publics will respond and will see that we're talking about people who have suffered greatly and who need our welcoming and need our assistance to get back on their feet and restore their lives back to normality.
Thank heavens Melanie speaks with optimism of her daunting task. On a very personal note, I asked her what her hopes are as day by day she tackles the mountain.
I hope that those of us who are lucky enough not to have experienced the sort of suffering that many refugees have gone through will reach out and be welcoming to those who have gone through this sort of difficult experience, and that we will push our governments to provide the sort of assistance and share responsibilities for refugees throughout the world.
And now Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director of the Beda College in Rome, brings us his own very special brand of spirituality, with a reflection on the Annunciation.
Last week, I was thinking about how the Lord stands at the door and knocks. And I was looking at the book of Revelation, chapter 3, and the rocket sent to the church in Laodicea, and how courteous God is when speaking to us where we are, at whatever level we're at, at whatever time in history. I thought today I'd just look at the amazing thing that's happening in the Annunciation. If you want to look at Luke chapter 1, verses 26 to 38. I've never met an angel. I believe totally in the world of spirit. Anyone who loves knows there's an area of reality which is beyond test tubes, litmus paper and thermometers. Scientists have to bow, as well as research. There's a wonderful man in England called Sir Patrick Moore, who's opened for me and for thousands of others the world of astronomy. And he is so modest and humble. He knows as much as anyone probably about the Crab Nebula. But the more he knows, the more he's amazed. There's something very attractive about someone who grows in humility as they grow in knowledge. There's nothing more ugly than an arrogant academic. No wonder Sir Patrick has such a following. He's a great teacher, because a good teacher is someone who's acquainted always with ignorance. Otherwise, he shouldn't be allowed anywhere near the ignorant. There are some professors who really should be not teaching, but should be doing research in libraries. Because to be a good teacher is a revelation. There is nothing in this world like a good teacher. So when they called our Lord teacher, he said, "Oh, God, I like that, say it again, because that's what I am." It's a wonderful thing to be a teacher. Well, the nearest things to angels I've met are my fellow human beings. They all have a little label round their necks with love from God. We're all messengers sent by God. And this is what a courteous angel does when he approaches Mary. It is actually the shape of all the sacraments. It is the way our Lord told us to approach people, because it is the way God, through his angel, approaches us. The first thing the messenger does was to greet the lady. Hail. You could walk into a room and say, "Morning all." Didn't look at anyone. To feel greeted means you feel you are someone, not something. You grow 6 inches tall. It's a wonderful thing to be treated as someone. It costs nothing. With our eyes and with our attention, if we treat someone as someone, they become someone. It's a miracle. It's a wonder. It's more significant than anything that happens at Lourdes or anywhere else. The second thing the messenger does is to compliment the lady. Just as there are many people in the world who've not been greeted and not treated as someone, but as something, another national insurance number, another mouth to feed, so also we're not very good at complimenting each other. When was the last time somebody told you, "You make the best rice pudding in London"? Oh, that was years ago. We need complimenting regularly. There are so many things in this world telling us, undermining us, that we're really not very good. Have you noticed in superstores, people keep looking at each other's trolley? I've met people, and they didn't look at me, they looked to see what I'd bought. And there's a great one-upmanship going on. Oh, chocolate-coated ants, really. Is that the latest thing? If I stood there with a packet of All Bran without blushing, that's great. How old is your car? Where do you go for your holidays? Do you go to North Africa as opposed to Spain? They don't let you know it's 10 more minutes in a plane, but it sounds more exotic. The whole game of advertisements is really telling you you're not all right. You think you've been having deep sleep for the last 30 years, do you? Well, we're telling you, you can't have deep sleep unless you have this hot chocolate drink before you go to bed. There is a group of us into this hot chocolate drink, the like of which others couldn't imagine. There's a sort of nirvana, deep sleep. So many people think, "Oh, I thought I had been sleeping all right. Obviously, I'm not. I have to buy this chocolate drink now." Your face. Oh, are you like some of the film stars? You better go and have a facelift. Go to Baden-Baden, to the spas. The whole of the advertisement industry is aimed at telling you you're not all right. You have needs, the like of which you would never understand. And so people spend their money on trivia. By God's grace, I am who I am. And in prayer, God wants to greet us. Cheer him. He wants to compliment us. You're full of grace. And the word grace simply means gratis, free love. Do you realise you and I have been loved into being? usually with human beings, we get to know each other exist first, and then we may or may not get round to loving each other. That's the order of events. But with God, it's the other way around. He loves us first. That's why we exist. So if you have any doubts about your existence, just pinch yourself and say, wow, he loved me. That's why I am. So I beg you, never ever again try to get God to love you. The blockage isn't God, it's us in allowing ourselves to be loved. You know, we're uptight, hard to get. Because if we allow ourselves to be loved, we change. And in change, there's always a growing pain. I used to think I was a sort of pot. Sort of pot you keep under the bed, really. Nothing much to look at. Other people were Dresden china on the mantelpiece to be admired. And then the potter started mucking around with me and pulling me about. And I realised I'm a teapot. He's done the handles, I'm still waiting for the spout. Because we're naturally conservative with a small c. We don't like to be changed because we have to be more responsible. We make more mistakes as well. But his love is gratis, it's free. So I beg you, don't try to get God to love you or buy his love with prayers and good works. Just allow him to love you and know that you've been loved into being. Well, Mary was a bit surprised at this greeting and thought perhaps you've come to the wrong address. And so the messenger said, do not fear. There've been missionaries and people who've spread fear throughout the world in the name of Christ. I've spent my whole priestly life trying to undo their damage. Supposing I was at Dover waiting for Napoleon to invade us. Well, we'd have all our guns out. We'd have all the sentries ready and a ship appears. And we think, stand by. And as the ship got near, we realised it didn't have any guns. It only had cauliflowers on deck. Eventually I'd have to say to them, my soldiers, OK, have a coffee break. Of course, the French ship might have had guns under the cauliflowers. We're always at risk. But for all sorts of reasons, we're naturally afraid. My hands, which can play Beethoven and Mozart very well, sometimes look like talons. You know, rather threatened. How are we disarmed? We're only disarmed and remove fear when somebody approaches us who has no arms at all. So I beg you, sometime, just sit in front of the picture of the Madonna and Child. Don't talk to it. Just let it speak to you. What religion in the world is there that has a God, a Son of God who comes to us without teeth in his gums, his fingernails couldn't scratch you yet, in need of a diaper change, hungry, thirsty, utterly vulnerable. He couldn't harm you if he tried. That'll disarm us. Or just sit in front of the cross. Don't talk to it, just let it speak to you. Sans teeth, sans breath, sans everything. He's the wounded one. He couldn't hurt you if he tried. So in your prayer, just sit, if you like, in front of the cross. And in front of the Madonna and Child, and listen to the angel's message, do not be afraid. And next week, I'll continue with the Annunciation.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.